Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about Ocean of Trade, South Asian Merchants, Africa and the Indian Ocean, circa 1750 to 1850 by Pedro Machado. The book is published by Cambridge University Press, and Pedro is Assistant Professor in the Department of History at Indiana University, Bloomington. Ocean of Trade is a richly detailed and engaging account of Gujarati merchants and their role in the trade of textiles, ivory and slaves across the Indian Ocean. I really enjoyed reading it, and I had the pleasure of talking with Pedro just a few moments before. So without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Pedro to the show. Thanks a lot for coming on, and thanks a lot for your wonderful book.
Well, thank you, Ian, for having me. It's a real pleasure.
I'm looking forward to talking about your book. So, but before we do talk about that, I was wondering, can you first please tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your academic background, actually, and your research interests prior to Oceans of Trade?
Sure. Well, prior to Ocean of Trade, I was, I was someone who was born and raised in Cape Town in South Africa. And from fairly early on, I did an undergraduate degree at the University of Cape Town. I became sort of interested in the kind of intermingled histories you find in Cape Town. You know, Cape Town's been a very interesting sort of port city. It's had connections to the Atlantic. It's had connections, of course, to the Indian Ocean as well. Some of those sort of articulated through a sort of a Dutch empire. And so you find really interesting sort of communities in Cape Town. But then also, you know, partly through some family trips up to the sort of east coast of South Africa to places like Durban, especially, which has a very large sort of, from all over the subcontinent, has a very large South Asian sort of population and South Asian communities. And I remember quite vividly going to this particular sort of market and, it's a cliche, but all these sort of spices that were being sold in this particular market kind of left an impression on me. And food actually, and the kind of the pathways of food. Although I don't work on food, but that sort of got me interested in this sort of the larger histories in which, certain places in South Africa, particularly coastal places, were sort of embedded or a part of. I started thinking about this sort of, some more. I trained, as I said, at the University of Cape Town and was an English and history major. And I did mostly, African history and mostly sort of Southern African history. Some courses on slavery and things like that. But it was really only when I started doing an MA, which I did at the University of New Hampshire in the United States, that I started getting a bit more serious about trying to think about a project that would, in some way sort of speak to these kind of entanglements, these sort of larger, histories. But I didn't want to work so much on South Africa. I wanted to work on other places. And that's really what actually took me out of South Africa, because at the time, this is the early 1990s, it was not that easy to find people to work with if you didn't work on South African history. And so I eventually landed up for my PhD at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, in London. Where I worked with a wonderful supervisor called William Gervais Clarence Smith. He was influential in helping me shape the topic. And that's when I sort of really started then developing this idea of sort of networks and exchanges. And I was interested in trade history, certainly, but I wanted to see if I could develop, a project with legs that would look at the sort of interactions between, parts of sort of Southeastern Africa and South Asia. And that's how I sort of, got going, and through conversations, with him. And again, he was very generous. I could go, I remember going into his office many times on a Friday afternoon and, leaving like 2 hours later after we'd had just a kind of free-flowing conversation. So he was incredibly, useful as a sort of interlocutor, and helped me think a lot of things through. And so that's how that developed. Originally, sort of looking at kind of Indian merchants then in Mozambique was sort of the project. And that's kind of what the PhD thesis was. you know, but it then, you know, which was fine. But I was always interested, and this is also then what I was able to do in the thesis dissertation, was not just look at Indians sort of in Mozambique, but then also the kind of interactive history. So, and that's where, anyway, we can talk more about this, you know, but that's where then sort of questions about consumption and so on came in, trying to also bring then India into the picture and kind of try to think about, you know, the sort of movement through circulation rather than kind of diaspora, meaning not so much Indians leave point A and go to point B, and then you look at point B, but actually trying to think about kind of back and forth movement and indeed a kind of, you know, circulation or circulatory kind of networks. And that's really then what I developed sort of, you know, for the book. I did a bit more research and wanted to think more about mobility and sort of migration in a kind of circulatory sort of way. So that's where the book sort of, you know, emerged from.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So, and that gives us a nice leeway into talking about the book and even the first line of the book, because the first line of the book I like very much. It's Lakshmichand Motichand was enmeshed in a world on the move. So I suppose a good question to help us situate ourselves. I mean, we've talked about Africa and we know South Asia, but who was this figure and when and where was he enmeshed?
Sure. Well, you know, I would have liked throughout the book to have had much more biographical information than I was able to get. But what little I could get for Lakshmichand Motichand was he was an important, you know, figure, an important, probably almost sort of sure of this, an important agent for, you know, his family back in, you know, back in Diu, which is the sort of island Andropo, off the coast of what is today Gujarat, you know, the Katiaba coast. And Lakshmichand arrives on Mozambique Island, which is this island off the coast of northern Mozambique, which for a long time was, you know, a really important also sort of entrepot. It gets eventually sort of overshadowed in the 19th century by Zanzibar. But it was a very, very important entrepot in previous, you know, centuries and indeed even into the 19th. And he arrives in Mozambique Island as a young boy in the 1760s or so. You know, he's someone who kind of, as far as I can tell, kind of moves up the ranks, you know, learns the kind of business in Mozambique, also learns, which not all merchants, you know, spoke, but learns at least one, you know, local African language, but of course is, you know, is a Gujarati speaker, but also knows Portuguese. And so he becomes a sort of, you know, this prominent figure who's invested in all sorts of trades, you know, most obviously the cloth trade. You know, textiles are important. We can talk a bit more about that perhaps later on. But also is invested in the ivory trade as well, in the procurement of ivory. But then also is invested, becomes invested in the slave trade. And then that ultimately means a connection to a kind of silver trade that sort of brings him into contact with the Atlantic, particularly the Southern Atlantic, and sort of slavers from Brazil, but also from the Rio de la Plata. And so that's, you know, that's who he is. But again, I would have liked to have had many more biographical details, but often it was very difficult to sort of access you know, these lives with any great, you know, sort of detail.
No, but it's nice. And the fact that his story opens the book really takes you there straight away, which is why I enjoyed it so much. So before we talk about these other chapters a little bit more in depth, one of the sort of more general arguments that you're making in the book is the importance of consumption for understanding trading routes, the South Asian merchants in this period. So could you please briefly explain why this was an important focus for you?
Sure. You know, I was, along with, one or two other people whom I'd met on the kind, you know, during the sort of PhD years, who then had become, you know, sort of colleagues at other institutions. The thinking was, you know, particularly in regards to, you know, to Africa, to Africans, right? The idea is that Africa and Africans enter, you know, enter kind of larger histories as producers, right? So either as, you know, as slaves, right? Or as kind of, you know, workers, right? On mines, you know, et cetera, in the kind of later, you know, sort of late 19th and the 20th century. So it's always sort of African Africans as producers. But what if we sort of invert that? What if we think about the place of Africa and of Africans as consumers, as buyers and consumers of a variety of products? And in my case, that was cloth, because, you know, historically, cloth has been particularly Indian cloth, Indian textiles, and really cotton cloth. So we're not talking so much fine silks and so on, though there's some of that, but that tended to go to sort of Southeast Asia and parts of the Gulf and so on. But for Eastern Africa and Southeastern Africa, it was really cotton cloth, Indian cotton cloth, that was sort of central to exchange and to exchange networks. And so I wanted to sort of make arguments that kind of stressed the importance of, you know, what Africans were buying, the sorts of cloths that they were buying, the particularities, as far as I could identify them, or the types of cloths that they were, you know, looking to buy, that were also shaped in part by particular sort of, you know, social logics and cultural logics, you know, related to, in some cases, you know, fashion. So what was in, you know, one season, two seasons later was not, you know, and sort of make a case that, well, you know, these buyers, you know, have ideas about, you know, perhaps what, you know, might be appropriate for a particular kind of, you know, ritual purpose, or what might indeed sort of look good or not, and this, you know, and this changes. So they have this sort of, there is a consumption story here. These are sort of consumers who have an influence beyond their sort of, you know, immediate, you know, area, right? They in fact have an influence over many thousands of miles across the ocean, you know, back in India. So I wanted to start from there rather than start from looking at, you know, Africans as, you know, producers, as slaves, and, you know, what have you. So that's why. And then also, though, you know, consumption allowed me to then also think about India as a consumer of African ivory, for example, and indeed also as a consumer of African slaves, which is you know, a trade that's still not as well sort of researched as it could be. So, you know, you have this sort of almost reciprocal sort of you know, consumption that is driving exchange, and that's really what I wanted to you know, argue about, and to then go on to make an even bigger sort of point that we need to be attentive to the sort of consumption of and the importance of local markets to the structuring of exchange within the Indian Ocean, right? There was a lot of work done on the European trades, and, you know, a lot of work done on the European textile trade, meaning the, you know, the companies, meaning the East India Company, meaning even, you know, the Dutch, and their trades either within the Indian Ocean, the so-called intra-Asian trade, or then the trade to Europe. But of course, much of the cloth that gets exchanged and gets, you know, shipped around the ocean is not being shipped in European vessels, is not being sort of financed by Europeans, but it's being shipped and financed by, you know, Indian Ocean sort of networks, you know, trafficking networks. And so, but we haven't really looked in any great detail at those, at those local markets that are sort of driving much of this exchange. And so I wanted to put one little sort of brick in that, you know, in that in that wall.
No, and I think this comes across very well, because exactly you discuss both Southern Africa and South Asia as well. So this works very well throughout all of the chapters. Now, the merchants in which you focus on, these Vanya merchants, they shifted their trade route from the Arabian Peninsula and the Red Sea down to the southeast coast of Africa. And this is what your book explores. So I was wondering, could you first tell us why they shifted their area of activity?
Sure. I mean, these are these Banya networks are networks that you know, historically have been in the sort of you know, Arabian Sea, or what something should be called, the Afrasian Sea, meaning the sort of Western Indian Ocean. They've been active for many a century, right? Particularly in the southern Red Sea, in places like Mocha, etc. But they, you know, they start to face in the early part of the 18th century some, you know, some challenges. They start to be sort of face, you know, they start to face some restrictions on various sorts of practice, for example, including religious, but also sumptuary practice. And although they were in Mocha as a sort of as an important you know, place, an important entrepot, they had been granted a sort of a protected, you know, status, right, for which they paid a sort of, you know, a poll tax. You know, this is from the middle of the 17th, you know, century, the 1650s. They are granted this sort of protected status by the, you know, by the imam. In the early part of the 18th century, they are sort of starting to be, you know, forcibly converted. They are starting to be attacked. They're being sort of, you know, heavily, you know, treated. There's a sort of a heavy hand. You know, some, you know, some governors of Mocha are demanding things like large cash, you know, payments, cash loans from them that they never repay. And so Mocha becomes sort of an unfavorable, you know, place. And what you start to find is that, you know, these Banya, who, you know, are serving as bankers and, you know, as merchants and so on, they start to sort of leave Mocha, right? So the Southern Red Sea, and generally the understanding had been in the sort of historiography that they then sort of retreat back to Gujarat and, you know, end up sort of investing in the kind of ruling, you know, classes of the day, right? But what I sort of argue has been missed is that there's not really a retreat. There might have been some of that, but mostly what happens is that there's a reorientation. And this is really in keeping with the, you know, history of networks sort of more broadly, right? You know, networks often reorient, you know, the trade. They move from one place to another. They don't necessarily simply retreat, right? And so where do they go? They go to Southeast Africa. You know, they sort of move their capital and move themselves, you know, to places like Mozambique Island. I also wanted to just, by the way, I mean, there was an understanding, actually, particularly in a recent work, that these merchants do end up sort of, you know, coming back to the Red Sea, to places like Massawa, but only in the 19th century, within a kind of, you know, a sort of a commercial, you know, revival of the 19th century and increased British involvement in the region, meaning that they sort of, you know, they come in or they come back to the Red Sea, you know, so, again, to keep this, you know, sort of clear, you know, generally the story had been that they faced these sort of, you know, restrictive conditions in the early 18th, you know, century and retreat, right, and go back to Gujarat and are therefore sort of, you know, removed from, you know, from exchange and so on in the Western Indian Ocean. But they come back in the 19th, in the 1830s, 1840s in places like Massawa in the Red Sea, but kind of, you know, through a sort of European-led commercial revival in the region. Now, you know, there is something of a commercial, you know, revival in the region in which sort of European capital and European merchants play an important part. But I think what had been entirely missed was that there's this reorientation. And so that's the history that's sort of, you know, behind this move then to Southeast Africa. And, you know, these merchants sort of continued to be, you know, very prominent, you know, sort of players in exchange in the Western Indian Ocean.
Okay. Wonderful. Thanks for that. So they've reorientated themselves away from this Arabian Peninsula and down to Southeast Africa, but they've managed to keep these routes going for quite considerable amount of time. So I was wondering, how did they manage to keep their routes profitable?
Right. And again, I should say that, of course, various sort of South Asian, networks had been active on the East African, coast, including, Banya, but not in any great number and not in any kind of sustained way. And so it's only really in the from the early 18th century, because of the sort of reorientation, that you get this kind of sustained involvement of these networks. Now, how they maintained their routes profitable, we shouldn't overlook that, of course, there were, many shipwrecks, there were many failures, merchants, struggled at times. But I think what is key, something I sort of mentioned a few minutes ago, is their never control over, but access to the procurement of cloth. So Indian cloth is central to exchange. You can't really, in the 18th century, and indeed even in the early parts of the 19th, you can't do much of anything in East Africa, in Southeast Africa, without cloth. Right. And you must know what is in demand, hence, the whole consumption thing. you must know what's in demand. Otherwise, you can bring the wrong type of cloth, to the market, and you will have, a very poor sort of experience and won't get what you, what you come sort of looking for. So cloth is key, and merchants never, these merchants never control weavers or weaving labor in India. They never have, there are times, attempts are made, including by the Portuguese colonial state, to bring in sort of weavers into Diu, also into Daman, and that's, somewhat successful, but it doesn't really, it's not ultimately successful and doesn't really serve these African markets. So they're always working through sort of brokers, right? In the Indian case, they never have access. They never control weaving labor. And that's that is an important point, but they have access to this weaving labor through these brokers. And so cloth is really key, and Portuguese merchants, French merchants, and even Brazilian merchants never fully never had access to these procurement networks, right? And never, I would also argue, understood that, yes, there are different sorts of demand in Southeast Africa, and we have to be and there's changes, but also didn't have, because again, they didn't have access to, the cloth in the ways that these merchants had, and certainly also not in the kinds of, volume that these merchants had. I mean, we're talking about many sort of millions of pieces, in certain years. It's a very high volume trade, actually, that also then on the African side, these Gujarati merchants sort of organize quite effectively through African intermediaries and are very, very attentive to, what is in demand and what is not. So that's what I would say certainly gives them an advantage over their competitors and I think kept their routes profitable. I mean, again, it's hard at times to access certain figures and so on, in terms of rates of profitability and so on. It's cloth that is central.
Okay. So it's basically this understanding consumption patterns which allow these Gujarati merchants to be more successful than the European or the Arab traders at this time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Indeed. Absolutely.
Super. So let's think again about consumption, but rather than in Southeast Africa, in India, because there's a very interesting discussion in chapter 4. And here you tell us about the way ivory was used and how this impacts upon the vineyard business. So could you please talk us through how ivory consumption fits into the picture?
Sure. again, you know, this is a history that goes into, you know, quite remote periods, you know, from, you know, already by the sort of 7th and 8th, you know, centuries sort of CE, South Asia begins to emerge as a fairly significant market for East African ivory. So it's, you know, it's a trade with a very long, you know, history. But, you know, what we've had is sort of just kind of, you know, snippets. I wanted to try to give this history, you know, some more kind of, you know, some more detail, right? But also look at roots and so on. You would just have these, yeah, sort of very partial bits of evidence, but that would at least make it clear that this is a very old, you know, sort of trade. And, you know, why, you know, why East African ivory? This is really, you know, of course, India, you know, South Asia, right, you know, has elephants. But elephants in India tended to be used as kind of laboring animals, right, as sort of beasts of burden, if you will. And so were too valuable really to be slaughtered for their tusks in any kind of, you know, large numbers. But also tusks, kind of the Indian elephant, its tusks were never kind of large enough for carving, and were found only actually in male elephants. The African male elephant, though, the tusks are much sort of larger than the Asiatic elephant. Okay, but also African ivory wasn't prone to discoloring and wasn't of a brittle nature, which the tusks of Asian elephants were. And so, you know, so the interest in East African ivory, you know, really grows and intensifies from these early, you know, centuries. And it's used, you know, ivory is used in a variety of ways. It's used, you know, to make combs, to make arrowheads, to make sort of seals, even, you know, spindle whorls. So it's used in, you know, in warfare. Many Indian towns had ivory carvers, but the ivory in the 18th, you know, century that I sort of write about was used also in this variety of ways, but also that there again would have also been an older history used in as bangles, I should say, that were worn mostly by worn by married, though in some cases unmarried women. So, you know, along with other sort of items of jewelry, such as gold, for example, or indeed, you know, silver necklaces, ivory bangles are used by women as part of adornment practices that sort of denote wealth and social status. And ivory bangles, particularly for married women, were worn throughout their married life. But these were, you know, these were burnt whenever, you know, a husband sort of died, if a woman did also then, you know, through kind of, you know, funeral pyre kind of death, also then, you know, sort of die. But certainly at her death, these bangles, you know, were burnt. So there's this sort of the sort of constant need for ivory. This, you know, quite robust consumer demand in the 18th and 19th, you know, centuries. But also it's a practice that, although it was once sort of the preserve of wealthy married women, sort of gradually spreads down the social hierarchy. And so, you know, you find even sort of low caste women are able to afford them as, you know, symbols of marital bliss. Yeah, again, as I've said, you know, a wife didn't pass these bangles on to her daughters, but, you know, she broke them as a sign of grief at her husband's death, or they were, you know, or they were burnt. And, you know, certainly if she died before her husband, she was cremated along with her bridal ornaments, so the ivory was burnt.
Wonderful. Thanks for that. So we've talked a bit about cloth, or quite a bit about cloth, and we talked about ivory, but one of the other important commodities, sounds horrible to describe it as a commodity here.
Sure.
Of course, it was a commodity, was slaves. And these were also important, but in a slightly different way. So could you please tell us how these Vanya merchants were tied up or not in the trade in slaves?
Sure. So essentially, they get sort of tied up with the slave trade, because from the sort of early to mid 18th century, we see a development in slave trading that's it's sort of driven by French French demand in the Mascarene Islands, so Mauritius and Réunion. And French merchants are developing sort of a plantation type agriculture in the Mascarenes, tied to sugar, and this really intensifies in the late 18th, early part of the 19th centuries. Again, I should say that there was also an earlier history in slave trading, but this 18th century demand is quite a sort of significant demand, and it is driven at least initially by French slavers. And so you find that increasingly coastal and particularly interior sort of Mozambique, south sort of central South Central Africa, but even other parts of Southeast Africa become sort of sources for African slaves. Indeed, the island of Madagascar becomes also both a sort of importer and exporter of slaves in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And then eventually also you find that from sort of late 18th, early 19th century, that Brazilian slavers, but also sort of Spanish slavers from Montevideo, for example, come around the Cape to Southeast Africa, to the Mozambique coast, to purchase slaves as British patrols in the Southern Atlantic around sort of abolitionist measures start to affect some routes. It's still profitable to come all the way around the Cape and not go to what is today Angola for slaves for Brazilian merchants. And so places like Rio, for example, but also Bahia, start to import quite large numbers of Mozambique slaves. And so, Indian merchants, don't just watch this sort of unfold, but actually in many ways enable this sort of trade to occur because, again, of their access to cloth, cloth being important, as I've said, not just for the purchase of ivory, but also for the purchase of slaves. You have to... you have to acquire slaves with cloth. And these merchants who come from the Southern Atlantic, but also French merchants actually bring in large amounts of, silver coin, from, South America. And they're able to buy slaves with coin, actually, because there's a cloth intermediation, if you will. So in other words, although you could eventually buy a slave or slaves for silver, at some point those slaves will have been purchased in the interior with cloth, and so you find that these Banya merchants become shippers of great volumes of silver back to DU, back to Surat, for example, as well, precisely because of the cloth story, but also because silver is very much a sort of medium you can use in Western India to help sort of to help you with credit payments, etc. Gujarat, Western India is also a silver economy. As you all know, I'm sure, India has a very long history of being also sort of a coin economy, if you will, right? A coin currency economy, as well. So so these merchants become mostly as financiers, in some cases as shippers of slaves, but mostly as financiers of slave trading exchanges, but then also simply through their importation of cloth, they are effectively in a sense undergirding the slave trade.
Thank you. So we've talked a lot about these Vanya merchants' success and also how their route was established. But as you describe in the book, by the 1830s and into the 1840s, there was a decline in their trade routes. So I was wondering, what was the reason behind this decline?
Sure. Conventionally, the idea was that, already from the middle of the 18th century, various sorts of Indian Ocean sort of networks, South Asian and others, but especially South Asian, become increasingly sort of, subsumed under a growing kind of British imperial presence in the Indian Ocean. And so, merchants and merchant networks become kind of, assume these sort of subservient positions within a growing kind of British, hegemon, right? And I wanted to, partly write against that by identifying, competition from other South Asian networks, right? So we often, forget that. Although, again, this picture is now kind of, changing, really. And I'm sort of, hopefully a part of that, sort of change that. Within the Indian Ocean, of course, you have competition, between, merchant groups. It sounds like an obvious thing to say. But in this period, the great competition was seen to be, sort of European capital, British capital and the British imperial presence. But what is really in the 1830s and 1840s for these Banya merchants is Kachi Bhatia merchants, particularly from from a place that's also part of sort of Gujarat today, Kutch, particularly places like Mandvi in Kutch. These Kachi Bhatia, which have the sort of support of another important, they're sometimes overlooked, sort of imperial formation in the Western Indian Ocean, the Omani sort of empire, they start to become heavily invested in Zanzibar. It's not only Kachi Bhatia, but they are particularly, important. And they start, showing up and competing with these, Diu and Daman, Banya from around the 1820s or so. And you get, therefore, sort of complaints from these Banya that these Kachis are bringing in, cloth that Africans are beginning to buy. There's also, by this point, American cloth as well, American textiles, certainly start to, have an impact. There's an interesting history of sort of American, textile imports into East Africa. But it's mostly the competition from these Kachi Bhatia. And so this starts to undermine the position of Banya in Mozambique Island and along the sort of Mozambique Channel, but they will, again, in keeping with this larger history of reorientation, they will then these Banya will then reorient themselves, and they will then sort of go back to the Red Sea, and we'll find that they are then operating from around this time, 1840s, 1850s, in Massawa, in the Red Sea. And indeed, they sort of never quite leave Mozambique as such. You find that there are, Diu and Daman, Banya in Mozambique in the late 19th century into the 20th. But that's a history that's sort of, greatly under-researched.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. We've really sort of shot through what is a really rich book in a very short amount of time. So thanks for doing that. I really enjoyed reading the book. I'd like to recommend this to anyone who's listening. It's really, I knew nothing about this topic at all, but you to get totally immersed into this world of trade, and really is a fascinating and very readable book. So thanks very much. But my question now is, now that this book is out, what are your current and future research projects?
Thanks, Ian, for those kind words. I'm sort of working with some others. I'm part of a kind of a team that's looking at the pearl trades and at pearling in the Indian Ocean. And I think something will spin out of that. Well, I'll be contributing, and from that, I'll see if a book, if the next book will come out of that or not. It's a project that's trying to sort of bring the different pearling zones of the Indian Ocean, meaning the sort of Red Sea and Gulf, South India, Sri Lanka, and then the kind of Southeast Asian, kind of Northern Australian sort of waters, you know, into one kind of frame. And it's a very large sort of multi-year, you know, project. So I'm involved with that. I'm also interested, I'm getting more interested also in the kind of environmental histories of pearling, but also of some other marine products and kind of the history of, you know, marine product extraction from the Indian Ocean, but perhaps, you know, also beyond. I'm still seeing if I can, you know, I want to write a second kind of really ambitious book that will, you know, sort of speak to more than one, you know, kind of ocean. You know, I'm very interested in ocean frames, you know, ocean frameworks, but they can also end up being quite restricting if you only look at one ocean, because of course these exchanges, and that's what I sort of also try to do in Ocean of Trade, you know, these exchanges go beyond any one ocean. And so just talking about you know, the Indian Ocean or the Atlantic, you can sort of miss, if you have that as your frame, you can miss these sort of interconnections, these inter kind of regional, these interoceanic exchanges. So, you know, I'll see, you know, perhaps I'll end up writing a sort of a book on kind of a global history of pearling. That's something that I'm kind of is, you know, swimming around in my mind, no pun intended. Yes. you know, and then also maybe, I don't know, I've become interested also in things like sponges, you know, which, you know, they have a rich Caribbean history, but also a Mediterranean and so on. So, yeah, so I'm both starting to work, you know, on pearling, but, you know, I might extend that to, you know, other marine products. So, you know, so we'll see. We'll see.
Wonderful. Sounds absolutely fascinating. So we look forward to that sometime in the future.
Yeah, right.
Good. So there's nothing more for me to do apart from to thank you again for coming on the show, and thank you for your wonderful book.
And thank you, Ian, for your time and for those kind words, and well, and all the best.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Today we've been talking about Ocean of Trade by Pedro Machado. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you will again next time. Ta-ra.